from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with William Fisher, the new chair of the Butler Theater Department.
And just in time for Halloween, I'll talk with horror novelist Jonathan Jans.
Plus, I'll also talk with Butler creative writing professor Michael Daly, and we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Butler University's new theater department chair has more than 20 years of experience training actors and creating new theater works. Like his predecessor, John Green, William Fisher has regularly traveled abroad, and his experiences in England, Germany, and Iceland will surely inform some of his work with Butler students. William Fisher dropped in to share his observations about serving as the Ohio University School of Theater chair and first impressions of Indianapolis and Butler.
I come from a line of loquacious people. In fact, in some ways, I'm the opposite of that to a great extent. But so some of it came naturally to me. I actually don't perform now. I haven't performed for a long time. But it did come somewhat naturally. I actually entered arts. I was my strongest passion in the arts when I was younger was actually photography. Interestingly, though, and didn't lead me to design, which it sort of seems to lead me towards in my work as a director to a great extent, but a lot of my photographs did not feature human beings. Sometimes they did, but usually, or I'd travel, I'd go places, and I'd come back, and people would say, well, where are all the pictures of everyone you went with? Because I would spend time taking pictures of
the bridge or the mountain or the,
So composition and sort of a gut intuitive reaction to things, I guess, was what led me to that or what interested me there. But the acting, you know, that especially that entree into acting, which I think a lot of young people have, the kind of a place to be different and a place to find out about yourself in different ways. Maybe that was one of the things that led me into theater.
I suspect you draw on those qualities as an educator and have for the years that you've been teaching. That
sure.
You, even though you're no longer active as a performer, you remember that this is what kids can do, what young people can do as they get involved. And it's kind of magical when they discover I can walk on that stage and be somebody else.
Well, it's often the spark, or it's the thing that ignites something, and I think it propels young people a certain distance. And I think the thing that allows for a continuation or a further or deeper exploration into their work is whether or not there's trajectory beyond that initial kind of blast off.
How do you help them discover whether there is or not?
I think it's just by going. Well, first of all, I think it has to do with exposing people in teaching, especially to a broader variety of kinds of work. But of performances. I tend to approach things from the perspective of the performance as opposed to perspective from the written play, for example. So I think, and to draw parallels and analogies to other kinds of work in the arts, I think that that kind of specialness or that pretendingness, that pretending part of that most students, and most students come to theater through acting. Once getting beyond how good that feels, or what someone I've studied with a bit and admired greatly, Ann Bogart, says, once you get beyond the showbiz weasel part, that all young actors must have on some level, and all actors probably carry their whole lives. You want to show your stuff.
Sure.
But I think getting towards a deeper connection to the work is really what allows that to become part of what's going on instead of the only thing that's going on. So that gets them beyond the social parts of acting and theater, beyond really what I think is an initial attraction, the positive reinforcement of it, the ability to entertain and engage people in an audience in that way, to have close relationships with other people doing the same thing.
What are some of the tools you use to get beyond the showbiz weasel stuff?
I'm going to regret having said that.
No, you're not. No. It's a great descriptor.
Well,
she's a smart woman.
You know, I think it has to do with seeing the work as a training and education, as a process of learning about beyond the self. So I think really, well, for example, right now I'm the courses I'm teaching at Butler now are an inherited part of this curriculum. So
sure.
It's a learning experience for me as well, which is very exciting. Part of what interests me for the students there at Butler in this course, which is called The Idea of Theater, is actually to, right from the start, go beyond that as a premise and to try to do some research with everyone about where we actually are right now in time and space. That means geographically, as a society, as a culture, and what that means to us. So students are researching the history of Butler University, the history of Indianapolis and what theater has been in Indianapolis. Who makes the theater? Who has made it here? What it has been in Indianapolis and Indiana. And at the same time, looking not to our major arts centers necessarily, but even further, and looking at theater as it is part of other places. It's kind of bypassing or jumping over the idea that our references need to be either New York or even Chicago or even Louisville, and to be able to wonder what is the work of someone in theater? What is the work of someone who is a worker in the theater and who's life is not only dedicated to high artistic but high ethical or personal or other kinds of ideals. And Butler actually is an ideal place for this, I think.
And you just started to talk about this, but what, you know, you were at Ohio University for a long time.
Yes, I was.
A couple of decades almost?
Almost, 19 years.
Yeah,
now.
And what attracted you about the Butler job?
Well, many things. One, that the focus of the university itself is on teaching.
As opposed to research or supposed research, or
I should say, to what is referred to as the profession. I think that
I can see the all caps there.
Yeah, it's the I think it is. Certainly, there is a theater profession, and there are standards and practices and things that are important and that have tradition and have purpose. And as you know, and as we all know, it's also can be a very closed circle, and a self-referential circle. And actually, I would say it in all small letters, because it makes it's the profession in that way to me almost can sometimes become a diminution of the idea of high aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, it was a large state university with very developed graduate programs, especially in design. It's an extremely, extremely important program in this country in the design world. in a college of fine arts with great students, but it was a large place.
Mm-hmm. You didn't. You probably got to know all the students, but maybe not as well as maybe you will at Butler.
I imagine so. I knew all the students really eventually, or could get to know them. So it's a place that was that is striving and strives still to be comprehensive and to be complete. In instructing on professional levels, all of the aspects of theater. During my time there, I went in and was hired to first revise and head the BFA performance program, acting program. And over about a 5-year period in several iterations, this developed into what we came to call the BFA theater performance program. The reason for making this distinction was that it seemed to me, and to some extent still does, to some extent seems to me dishonest to promise a professional degree to people between the years of 18 and 21 who are not in a conservatory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We fashioned a program over the years that resembled more a model of an art school than a theater conservatory, which seemed appropriate to our students, to the moment, to the place that we were. And in a way, when this, I was perfectly fine at Ohio University.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sniff around here and there occasionally, and because people knew people,
mm-hmm.
and that's really where my attention was sort of drawn towards it. And I knew about the Butler Theater Program.
Mm-hmm.
The former chair, John Green, and I never met face-to-face, but corresponded with regularly because we had similar interests and were in sort of similar listserv worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew of the Butler Theater Department, and I was ready for a change from something large and unwieldy, and which a large department is of necessity. And then I came here, and coming here and meeting the people here, including students and including the superb colleagues in the theater department, including the new provost, or fairly new provost, and the extraordinary president of the university. It wasn't hard to make this decision in the end.
Sharon Gamble with William Fisher, new theater department chair at Butler University's Jordan College of Fine Arts.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Just in time for Halloween, a horror writer visited our studio. Jonathan Jans is the pen name for, well, we can't tell you that. What we can tell you is that he teaches English to junior high school students by day, and at night he writes some pretty scary stuff. Two of his novellas are available digitally through Amazon, Old Order and Witching Hour Theater. Travesty Nicola bravely spoke with Jonathan about his work.
Jonathan, welcome to Art of Matter. Great to have you here today.
Great. Thank you, Travis. It's wonderful to be here. I appreciate it.
And happy Halloween to you.
Well, you too as well. You too as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is the appropriate time of year to be talking about your work. You are a horror author, correct? I mean,
that's right. That's
horror
really,
fiction?
Exactly. That's where I tend to gravitate most often.
Now, the couple books that you've got out, novella and a book, I know they're available through Amazon. You're still sort of like trying to break into the whole thing, though, right?
Yes, absolutely. I have two novellas published, several short stories, and have also written a trio of novels.
Okay.
The third I'm editing. The other two, the first one almost got picked up, got an agent, didn't quite make it all the way to the publisher. And the second one is currently with agents, and they're kind of the gatekeepers to the publishers. So certainly in a sense trying to break through in a bigger way. But the two novellas have both done really well and have really been a lot of fun. I've had a lot of good reaction.
Well, I know that certainly like on the reviews on Amazon, you know, a lot of people posting that, really readable, fun, engaging, page-turner type of stuff, which is obviously what you want for a good horror story.
Absolutely.
Tell me a bit about the two different ones. Let's start with Old Order, because when I first started reading a little bit about this, for just a very brief moment, I thought, oh my God, it's like an Amish horror story. It's not, though, but
well, yeah, there's something
about
that. Yeah.
You know, I mean, the whole sort of world of Amish romances is sort of taken off lately, and for a moment I thought, maybe it really is an Amish horror story. So tell me why I thought that.
No, absolutely. No, it's funny. I mean, and there are stories, you know, that seem to pop up over the last few years that have dealt with, you know, Amish people and horror, and where the worlds of vampires and the Amish have been crossing, you know,
okay.
And crossbreeding a little bit. But the only thing Amish about this story is that the protagonist is a con man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's something inherently trustworthy. At least that's the stereotype. It's a positive stereotype, but I think that people tend to be trusting of those who are Amish. You know, the experiences that I've had personally with Amish folk have been wonderful. So this con artist recognizes that, and he sees an opportunity in that. So he poses is an Amish man that has been wrongfully shunned from his community.
Okay.
And he wears the chin whiskers, the hat, the whole nine yards.
And again, he's not Amish at all.
Not at all.
Okay.
Exactly. That's part of the dramatic irony of the story. We I think the very first line is a man calling himself Horace Yoder.
Mm-hmm.
So we immediately suspect that there's something amiss with this guy, that he's not all that he's saying he is. So he goes to unsuspecting families and farmhouses through the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually an antique dealer in Hartford, Connecticut. But what he does is he ingratiates himself with this sob story about how he covered for his brother who had stolen from the pastor. And, of course, the irony there is he himself is the actual thief.
Mm-hmm.
So he's painting himself as this sad case. And he proceeds to show up saying he'll work the next day for his room and board.
Mm-hmm.
To loot the family's jewels that night or whatever precious antiques they possess, and then leave early the next morning and therefore avoid any kind of manual labor.
Right.
And so he does pretend to be Amish, but he's anything but.
and then things just go worse from there.
Things go
as they should in a good horror story.
Absolutely, absolutely. I try to help the reader identify with him a little bit. He's not a completely detestable character. He gets a backstory. We get to hear how he became what he became. Had a tough relationship with his father, who was kind of a crazy man, he was a hog farmer who used to butcher hogs, and Horace would have to witness this butchery, and that, you know, implanted some fears in him that come to fruition later on in this story. But Horace, he proceeds to meet and, for lack of a better way to put it, be seduced by two of the female members of this family, the daughter of the farmer who owns the house, and then the wife of the farmer. And he,
so it sort of is like an Amish romance. There
it really is. There is a romantic element to it, and he believes his luck. Not only does he see canary diamonds, rubies, he sees jewels on the person
yeah.
of these family members, but he also, of course, experiences what he thinks, you know, is this family. Fantasy with these two beautiful women at separate times. You find out why these women. Horace isn't exactly a classic leading man, so you find out later on in the story why these women show interest in him. But it's certainly not because they're attracted to him. It's for a far darker purpose.
And that's where the horror comes in. But it sounds like that it's more actually suspense through most of it. That it's not, you know, like a crazy slasher thing going on through the whole book. It's It builds to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I love all kinds of horror. I love silly, dumb horror, splatter horror sometimes in film. But the type of horror I like the most is the suspenseful, the Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge, you know, fan of his work. And there's a lot of psycho to this story. You know, there's the aspect of voyeurism.
Mm-hmm.
In which Horace engages. There's a very slow build, and you know, it's that way by design. I love the way, of course, you know, it's my own work, so I'm biased toward it, but I love the way that Horace's misdeeds, his condescension, his implicit condescension in the way he treats these people. You know, he thinks he's brighter than they are. He thinks he's pulling the wool over their eyes. He has no idea the entire time that he's the one being played, so to
yeah.
speak. So it really is a suspense tale. The first, it's 31 pages long. The first 12 pages are kind of like an erotic mystery. The next 15 pages are pure suspense, mm-hmm. as he absconds with the jewels, thinks that he's gotten away with it, but then in the moonlight sees that he's being followed. And then the last 3 or 4 pages are where the horror really comes into play. But and that's the kind of book that I usually love. I don't need right. blood by the gallons.
Well, let me ask you this. What is it about the horror genre that most appeals to you? I mean, obviously the suspense is a lot of fun, but, you know, I mean, there is that element of sort of, you know, exploring the darkest possible, you know, psychology of humans and what people are capable of. I mean, that's, you know, is both, you know, it's titillating, it's enticing, it's also kind of creepy and freaky.
Absolutely. I think it is a fascinating thing to examine the dark places a human mind can go, the dark places that people go in their actions and words, and that is a big part of it. I think Stephen King was once asked, he's one of my, I think for most horror writers of
sure.
my generation, he's an inspiration. But one thing that he talks about quite a bit is the fact that people assume some sort of, and not that you were by this question, but people assume some sort of, you know, aberrant, you know, process going on in his mind. And he says, to the contrary, he believes horror writers are the healthiest people in the world because we get to exercise our demons on the page. We get to, exactly. And I think that's the case. And I think that's one thing that appeals to me. I grew up between a graveyard and a cemetery. And, you know, my entire life, I had nightmares of what mm-hmm. would come out of the cemetery, what was lurking in the woods. And I have always been fascinated by that potential, the potential for nightmare in the everyday. And through my writing, I'm able to, whether you call it, you know, exercising my demons or, you know, that it's like my metaphorical psychiatrist couch, I get to lay bare all these things that frighten me and all my worries and insecurities go out on the page. And I think it's a really healthy way of dealing with them. I'm a husband and a father of 3 kids. I'm the gentlest person I know. When we find a spider, we put it on a piece of paper and carry it outside. Mm-hmm. There's not a, you know, cruel bone in my body, but my characters act that way. And I think that, you know, part of the reason why I'm so gentle is because it all comes out on the paper.
On that note, and I'm just taking your word for it that you're not really a creepy guy, but on that note, you know, but have you ever written something where you felt like, whoa, you know, like you sort of freaked yourself out or horrified yourself, or maybe you felt like, you know, it went too far or something?
Absolutely. At the end of Old Order, I felt that way to a degree because the story does get very, very dark very fast mm-hmm. near the end. Has a really diabolical climax. Another time that I did that, there's a story, it's available online, called The Clearing of Travis Coble. And that story was inspired by Lizzie Borden and mm-hmm. how she was, nobody really knows if she was guilty or not, but people suspected her to be guilty even after she was acquitted. So this idea of innocent guilt or a person being innocent but still being a pariah
right.
was fascinating to me. The end of that story I read, and I actually, when I finished, it's funny. It's almost like automatic writing. You know, most writers, when they really get in the zone, it's not like work at all. There's no thinking involved. The characters are in control, and you're just along for the ride. And I wrote that way. When I went back and looked at what I had written, it really was. It was. I got chills. I was a little bit uncomfortable. I thought, boy, what kind of a madman, you know, came up with this? This is pretty sadistic, pretty awful. So certainly I've had that, you know, at the same time there's a sense of accomplishment with it.
Oh yeah, sure.
But there was also a little bit of me that was unnerved.
So what, Jonathan, what scares you from other authors?
Oh, interesting. I think for me, my biggest fear is something happening to my family.
Well, sure.
And every time that occurs in the story, specifically probably to one of my children.
Yeah.
And when I read something, you know, like Pet Sematary by Stephen King, I read that a long time ago. I don't think I'd be able to reread that now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too
now that you have kids.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just too possible, you know,
yeah.
And I guess it's always been possible, but, you know, every time we look at the news, we see something horrific
mm-hmm.
involving kids, and I can't even click on those links anymore because it is so frightening. But as far as things that scare me in fiction, it's really, I love the handling of a suspense scene. I love it when like Hitchcock, when an author takes the time to build up to something, you know, just gore for gore's sake
mm-hmm.
never has an effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm too desensitized. But when I have come to really care about a character, I think of a book by Jack Ketchum called The Girl Next Door. That book made me weep, and I think it was made into a movie, which I haven't yet seen. But when we come to care about a character, and then terrible things happen to the character, or the character's put in terrible situations, that really has an effect on me. But for me, whether I'm reading or writing, it's all about character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, otherwise, why am I invested in this story?
Tell me briefly about Witching Hour Theater.
Sure, of course. Witching Hour Theater was published a few years ago. The Old Order publisher was Untreed Reads, and they've been wonderful to work with. Witching Hour Theater, also available on Amazon, was published by Creative Guy Publishing. That story, it was actually born of a real life event. I don't know if I should share that or not. But,
sure.
Well, when I was
if you want,
yeah, of course. When I was a seventh grader, I've always loved movies.
Let's just be clear. Jonathan Jans is your pen name here. So
yeah, that's right. That's right. I guess I can speak as freely as I want. I have always loved film. Well, I remember going to movies with my seventh grade friends, and none of them had the same interest that I did. I would be the only one wanting to watch the movie. The rest of them would be annoying the people around us. The usher would come in and tell us to be quiet. Well, it was the 9 o'clock show. It was the late show, and the movie was The Believers with Martin Sheen, this movie about voodoo and zombies and all kinds of horrifying things. Well, they had all left to go to a friend's house. They were supposed to be at the theater. They had left. I was actually the good boy who stayed behind, like I had told my mom I would do. Well, it was a fairly empty theater. There were about 12 people there to begin with, but as the night went on, more and more people left. And I would glance over my shoulder periodically and take stock of who was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first time I did that was about 20 minutes in the movie, and there was a figure in the back of the theater. And didn't really think much of it because there were other people there, couples, trios of friends. I looked back about halfway through the film, and not only was there only one couple left, but the figure had seemed to advance, was about halfway up.
Creepy.
It was incredibly creepy, right? And,
of course,
I'm a seventh grader, and my mind is racing and conjuring the worst possible scenarios. So as the movie went on, the couple, I saw them walk by me with about 10 minutes left to go in the movie, and the climax was a frightening climax in the film. And, of course, then I'm alone with this figure. And that's where the true story ends. The true story basically is that I was too frightened to even turn around and look, so I just scampered out of the theater. There was an exit in front of me. In the story, Witching Hour Theater, it's a much different turn of events. He turns around and there's a figure. This is only about halfway through the story, but the figure. Well, I don't want to give it away.
No, but that's all right.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, and let's for last question to wrap this up. I mean, when you're looking at a horror story, you know, some fall within the realm of the supernatural to explain what happened, and others fall, you know, in the realm of physically what's possible and such in our world. Which camp do you tend to, you know, prefer your stories end up in? You know, that, you know, looking for that supernatural answer, whether it's, you know, vampires or werewolves or aliens or, you know, big spiders or what have you, or is it just, you know, really freaked out minds?
Right. I tell you, I've written both and enjoy both. I think the most interesting stories are often ones with supernatural elements, but those are used as lenses into ourselves. I don't like when it is simply, you know, a werewolf movie, you know, the kind of movie we've all seen, or a vampire movie. I always like it when a lot of the horror comes from, you know, human beings. You look at the best zombie movies, and there are certain tropes that are repeated in those subgenres. In the zombie movie, it's always the human beings who end up being the worst antagonists. 28 Days Later, I always remember. But the human beings, the soldiers who seem to be protectors, are actually the most monstrous, much worse than the zombies, who are these single-minded creatures. And I think that human complexity and that capacity for darkness is so fascinating, and through the supernatural that can really be laid bare and examined. And I think that's really my favorite kind of story. Now, Old Order doesn't have anything overtly supernatural, but again, it is in the human where the most frightening things.
But Witching Hour Theater may.
Witching Hour Theater. It's funny. It seems to be going in a supernatural direction, and then it turns out to, again, I don't want to give it away much, but it actually turns out not to be. It's similar in Old Order that the horrors are real.
Travis DiNicola with horror writer Jonathan Jans. His novellas, Old Order and Witching Hour Theater, are both available on Amazon. Just search for Jonathan Jans, and Jans is spelled J-A-N-Z. Trick or treat!
Sharon, what are you wearing?
It's up to your interpretation. It is a costume, though. Yeah. Thank you for noticing. And I even have my official Halloween socks on, see?
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. Well, I won't say you look like a pumpkin, more like an orange kitty cat.
Aw. We're going to scare up some fun things to do on our calendar that we call
What'll We Boo?
Oh, boo. How could I forget that? Hey. We're going to burn some calories today.
You know what? I want to let people know about Safe Night Halloween is taking place over at the fairgrounds, Indiana State Fairgrounds, on Halloween, the 31st, in the South Pavilion. Hours are from 5 to 7 p.m. Admission is free for children 12 and younger. They must be accompanied by an adult, and they should be in costume. But speaking of kitty cats, the Indiana Cat Club Cat Show is also going on this weekend in the Northwest Pavilion. That's both on Saturday and Sunday. So if you get the two confused, well, that's
please take
why.
Pictures if you dress up your felines. I want to see it. this is good for people of all ages. It's the Butler Symphony Orchestra concert this Sunday afternoon at 3. Yes, it is on Halloween, and you can celebrate Halloween with the Butler Symphony Orchestra as they play selections from movie music like Psycho, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and other classics. Free admission, no ticket required. Just show up at Clues Memorial Hall on Halloween at 3 o'clock.
There's a pretty cool partnership between Second Story, the program that works with kids in writing, and St. Vincent Hospital. And their question is, are you driven like Danica? And it's a writing competition for girls grades 6 through 12. Sort of an essay contest where they get a chance to meet Danica Patrick, win a trip to American Idol. And so are you driven like Danica? And the question is basically for them to write an essay, 300 to 500 words, about what drives you. Very, very cool stuff. And you can get more information if you just Google Driven Like Danica or go to 3384-HER, her. That's 3384-HER for more information, or check out Second Story as well.
Very good. A reminder that you can still catch Skeletown at the Children's Museum for this weekend. Very good. And it was recently named as one of the top 10 haunted houses in the country and one of the most family appropriate. So Skeletown at the Children's Museum.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, the Acoustic Cafe series starts this weekend again, Saturday night, with a show down at the Wheeler Arts Center in Fountain Square. And it is featuring Beth Neal Wilson Chapman, she will be performing works from her new CD, Back to Love, sort of like a Faith Hill, Bonnie Raitt type of stuff. A lot of fun. Tickets are available at the door. Show starts at doors open at 6:30, and again, show starts at 7 down at the Wheeler Arts Center Saturday night.
Excellent. Hey, don't forget, one of my favorite events of the entire year is going on this Saturday at the Indianapolis Arts Center from 3 to 8. If you're listening on Saturday afternoon, you can still go over and catch the rest of the Dia de los Muertos celebration with all sorts of free family-friendly activities. Learn about this traditional celebration and put some money in your pocket, because there's food and beverage available for purchase as well, and all sorts of cool artwork to look at, including the art by Erica Villarreal, who did the Party in the Sky exhibit, which is at the Indianapolis Arts Center celebrating Day of the Dead.
Well, that sounds very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing I've got is put it on your calendar for next weekend, Friday the 12th. There'll be a talk and lecture by the author and memoirist, Tom Larson. He's going to be talking about his new book that is an exploration of Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings.
Hmm.
And this is a program that has been brought to Indiana through the Indiana Writers Organization. If you go to indianawriters.org, you can get more information on Tom Larson. He's also doing a class on the 13th.
My last thing is not exactly a Halloween event, but it does have a creepy aspect to it. I wish you had more than one holiday a year where you could use that laugh. That is so cool.
I use it at Christmas, but it freaks everybody out.
We'll get into that deeper for our holiday special. On the Rick's Wild Theater Company stage in Greenfield is Arsenic and Old Lace playing through Halloween. Yeah, Friday and Saturday shows at 7:30, Sunday matinee at 2:30. If you've never seen it on stage but only seen it as a movie, you owe it to yourself to go see it live.
Very, very fun play.
Meanwhile, you should send us your leftover chocolate after the holiday.
Sure, candy apples or whatever else, popcorn balls. A care of Art of the Matter, and we'll be back next week with without costumes, but more things to do on.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Michael Daly is a gentleman. Well, you have to be one to write a novel called The Gentleman's Guide to Graceful Living. Michael is a visiting assistant professor and Booth Tarkington writer in residence at Butler University this year, and he recently shared his delight in the Midwest with Sharon Gamble.
There was not... My mother read novels. My dad, I think he read one, as far as I remember, my entire life. What I'd say, though, is that my father was probably the best storyteller I've ever known in my life, and... So while he wasn't, I mean, he was a really smart guy and well-educated, just reading novels wasn't his thing, but he could keep you up till 4 a.m. telling you stories, and the time would fly by, and you just think it was such a great experience that you'd kind of want to duplicate it. And I think that as I got older, I think I started seeing myself as a storyteller, and writing seemed to be a good way to do it.
Did you entertain your friends or your classmates, or... Were you the guy who, when somebody said, what'd you do on your summer vacation or what'd you do over Labor Day weekend, did you find yourself embroidering the truth? Or?
Yeah, I think actually rather my audience was mostly non-existent. So in other words, I tended to be a kind of a daydreamer in school and you know, into my 20s and 30s. So... the people who I was telling stories to were imaginary, or they were my father just sort of in my head as I was rehearsing something.
Oh, that's so reassuring.
What
you just said, there are, you can't see them because it's radio, but there are people driving in their cars or listening at home nodding going, thank you. I did that too, or I do that too still.
Yeah, I think it's pretty common. And it's also, it's very pleasurable. I mean, I walk all the time. I walk less since I've been to Indiana and now have a car. But I mean, I could blow hours and hours just walking around, rehearsing my stories or telling funny stories to imaginary people. I'm not sure I should be confessing this, but I guess it's too late.
There is nothing wrong with having a rich interior life.
Yeah, I suppose.
Just depends on how you package it, right?
Yeah.
But at some point, maybe in high school or college, somebody said, so what are you going to do for a living? And was there kind of a decision point where you said, hey, maybe I can do this for a living. Maybe I can do this thing that I love and enjoy so much for a living.
Well, I when I was in college and then afterwards I went to in graduate school, I had this idea that I was going to be a scholar. And so I went to get my PhD in history at the University of Wisconsin. But I was reading a lot of novels for something that I was working on and decided that that writing fiction was maybe the thing that I wanted to do. So it really wasn't until I was about 26 or 27 that I decided to do it seriously. I had written some short stories before that, but not with any kind of purpose or plan. So it wasn't really till I was 27 that I really figured I'd try to make it as a fiction writer.
How are the fields related? Obviously, being steeped in history, European history was your field, right?
Right.
Has some bearing on what you write in your fiction.
It's true. I think that the best thing it did for me is it made me read for a lot of years historical work, and so the language that I use and the things that I'm interested in and the way I construct a story tends to have a kind of formal aspect to it. And I think that I really benefited from being out of this sort of the young fiction writer stream, because there's a lot of stuff that I haven't read in terms of contemporary fiction, but that can sometimes lead you astray because you get into this sort of you start sounding and writing like everyone else. And it was nice that my background was in historical work.
And you weren't out there hanging out at the young writers cocktail party circuit where everybody had to. This was the fad, and this is the way we're writing now.
No, I was never invited. Even even in New York, when I was after I had sold a book, no one invited me anywhere.
That sounds like a blessing.
Well, you know, I'm part of having a rich interior life, as you so nicely put it, is I'm extremely shy, and I also every time I went to a party where there were a lot of artists in New York, I reverted to what I was like in seventh grade. I had started to panic that my hair was all wrong, that I was wearing the wrong clothes.
Aww.
I didn't know what anyone was talking about. So it wasn't very much fun. I mostly hung out with bankers in New York because they just thought I was a freak. They couldn't figure out how I survived. But I was just that funny guy who lived out in Brooklyn, and they'd invite me along. I was
great.
Like,
you were a microeconomic study for them.
Yeah, exactly. I was their amusing sidekick.
But that was your father's field, banking.
It was. Although I have to say that, you know, my father, I kind of never grasped the whole difference between what my dad did and what goes on in New York until the financial crisis, because my father was a commercial banker, so. He was a successful banker, and he did international banking, but his job was all about lending companies money, as opposed to sort of, I guess, the people who I call bankers in New York that I know who are, I don't really know what they do, but they invest in things and somehow end up with hundreds of millions of dollars. So, but that's not what my dad
lifetime
was doing.
You'll find out what that's like.
My son, I'm encouraging, well, he's only two, but... I'm definitely not going to teach him to write, or maybe not even to read.
You're turning on the marketplace money for him in the car every night. I can just hear it now.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have two younger sisters, one who is 2 years younger than me and one who's 12 years younger.
Writers, artists, or did you get all those chromosomes?
No. The sister who's 2 years younger than me is a children's book author and illustrator.
Ah.
And she, her first book she illustrated for David Mamet, in fact. And
really?
Yep. Yeah. And then she had a book a couple years later called Bernelli and Harriet. It was a children's book that is now my son's favorite book. We tried to get him to read it forever, and he just was not interested. And then suddenly, this is his favorite book. My sister, who's 12 years younger, is actually a television producer. And... She does a lot of artistic stuff, and she does a lot of more commercial stuff. She's got a show coming out with Vanilla Ice, Flipping Houses. How about that?
Cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Well, she lived in Greenpoint back when I was living in Manhattan, and Greenpoint is this. I mean, I love it, but it's kind of a groovy neighborhood in Brooklyn, and it's been really nice for me because I had access to sort of. The culture of people in their late 20s in Brooklyn, which of course I'd never get invited to these things if I was 39, and there too, since I was such a kind of oddball, why is that 30 something here? I never worried about my hair or how I was dressed, or I didn't never reverted back to my seventh grade self.
You're going to get so many invitations after this airs, I'm just telling you.
I'm available. I'm married, but I still like to go to dinner
parties.
Available
for going out and talking good talk with people. You're not a stranger to the Midwest. You went to Washington University down the road in St. Louis, about 5 hours from here. How has Indiana, or specifically Indianapolis, struck you so far? Is it what you expected it to be?
You know, it is... almost exactly what I expected it to be, believe it or not, mostly because I spent 2 years in St. Louis. But I also grew up in Minneapolis till I was eight, which is similar. But so, it's been great. We've absolutely loved it. And, I mean, this is just a typical New York problem, but all we want to do is talk about real estate because it's such a nightmare and such an ongoing sort of issue in New York. but we just have such a nice house and we're paying such a reasonable amount for it, and it's kind of astonishing. We had a tiny apartment in New York, and with a 2-year-old, it was fine, but it was definitely time to get out of there by the time we left. But he's got a backyard with a fence and
do you have a dog yet?
No, we don't have a dog.
It's the next step. It's a slippery slope. Be careful.
Well, the thing that he understands that people own dogs, but I don't think he's put it together that it's possible that we could have one. So we're kind of dreading when
we won't tell him. I know the bread and butter while you're here of your life is teaching at Butler, but talk about your writing habits or disciplines, and is it different being here than being in Manhattan?
It is different. I've only been here for about 5 weeks, and so I still feel like I'm figuring out my schedule. I've gotten some pretty good writing done though, and one of the problems with teaching it is a time commitment, but unless you're just unless you've independently wealthy, you've got to do something for money, and as time commitments go, it's not that bad. The problem with teaching is that it's extremely fulfilling, and when you're trying to discipline yourself to write, it's easy to procrastinate by, for instance, reading one of your student stories or writing comments or rereading a novel that you want to talk about, and at the end of the day you've blown off your writing, but you still feel like you've accomplished something. And I think that's a thing that I'm going to have to get used to, disciplining myself not to do this thing that is in fact important and lots of fun.
And at the risk of giving away trade secrets, because we want people to go to Butler and enroll in your class to find out this, but how let me use a very specific example. How did you write about the protagonist of A Gentleman's Guide to Graceful Living? How did you write about Arthur Camden, who's twice your age, had a completely different career from you? Where do you get that information to be able to create characters who are not autobiographical?
Well, it's actually, I think it's a lot easier to write about people that are not myself. I was a temp at Oscar Mayer for a year once,
sorry, it's not really funny, but
well, it was actually. I really loved the job, but of course, it's you're working in a sausage factory, and it certainly wasn't kind of where I wanted to be for my whole life. And I really like to write something about it, but every time I sit down to try to do it, it just never feels like I've got it quite right. I think that there's this idea that fiction writing is sort of an act of truth telling. But I think that one of the things that's going on when you're writing fiction is you're creating an illusion, and you're creating the illusion of truth. And I find it's much much easier to sort of be writing about someone else than myself to create that illusion. The one thing that I'd say, and I keep reverting back to seventh grade because I moved in seventh grade from London to New Jersey of all
wow.
places, and it was quite a transition. And A Gentleman's Guide is really it's spiritually and emotionally it's about that year because like Arthur, the protagonist, I was lost in a social world that I did not understand at all, and so I suppose, details aside, there is something autobiographical about A Gentleman's Guide.
How do you resist the temptation to make it come out better for a character than it maybe did for you in real life?
Well, I tend to write stories often. Things come out well for Arthur in my novel, but a lot of my short stories, things end up pretty bad for the characters. But in the process of watching someone suffer or go through troubles, you feel a lot of love and compassion for them. So the temptation is never to make things good for the character. The thing that I'm always working to do is make the reader feel something deep towards the people that they're reading about.
What are you working on now? I realize I'm really putting pressure on you because you're barely settled in Indianapolis, but I have to ask.
I have a couple short stories that I'm finishing up, and I have a novel that I'm finishing up, and I guess that's it. That's probably enough. I don't know.
I think that's more than, and you have a 2-year-old and a wife and a full-time teaching gig.
Exactly.
Plenty to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where do you think you'll be a year from now?
That's a good question. I ask myself that every night at midnight as I lie awake staring into the darkness.
I'm so sorry.
I mean, I love this gig that I have, and it's really fun. It's in fact always what I wanted with my life, to kind of go to different places and check them out for a while and then head somewhere else. So this is kind of exactly where I want to be, but it is an interesting set of problems being kind of a transient writer and teacher, because you don't know what's next. I mean, yeah, I don't know, but it's really great, I think, kind of being on the road like this.
Sharon Gamble with Michael Daly, assistant professor and Booth Tarkington writer in residence at Butler University, and the author of The Gentleman's Guide to Graceful Living, as well as short stories and screenplays. Learn more about his work at michaeldaly.com, and that is spelled Michael, DAHLIE.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll chat with well-known food writer Michael Pollan, who will be visiting Indy on November 12th as part of the Spirit and Place Festival.
And I'll talk with some visiting authors who are coming to town for the Ann Katz Festival of Books at the JCC, including Robert Egger, the founder of the DC Central Kitchen, upon which our own Second Helpings is modeled, and comedian Annabelle Gervitz, who has a new book on preserving marriage.
Plus, there's our Arts Calendar Week Hall.
What'll we do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.